Good morning again. The court calls United States v. Riley. Counsel for the appellant, please. Good morning again, yes.
Good morning. Chief Judge Baker, members of the court, I am Captain Brandon Erie, and along with Colonel Patricia Hamm, we represent Private Cassandra Riley. Simply put, Private Riley could not make an informed decision to plead guilty. Private Riley did not know she would have to register as a lifelong sex offender, and this responsibility to inform her failed on two separate levels. One, her defense counsel failed to inform her, thus prejudicing her ability to make that informed plea. And number two, the military judge failed to ensure that defense counsel complied with this court's decision in U.S. v. Miller in light of direct and on-point instruction from the military judge's bench book.
Counsel, do defense counsel, in order to be effective, have to know everything?
No, Your Honor. The defense counsel does not need to know everything. But with this court's decision in U.S. v. Miller and subsequently in U.S. v. Rose, this court emphasized that defense counsel should know, set as forth as a recommendation.
No, I'm well familiar with Rose because I think I wrote the opinion for the court.
Yes,
and I don't think that that's exactly what it said. Here's a question. In this case, there's no sexual overtones whatsoever to what occurred, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you agree with that?
I do agree.
And so do you think that it would be a surprise to everyone that that was a listed offense for registering as a sex offender?
Your Honor, it was a surprise to the parties involved with this court martial.
Okay, so let me just take it a step further. If in this case, instead of being charged with kidnapping, she was charged with larceny, and surprise, surprise, larceny was also listed as an offense for which you would have to register as a sex offender, do you think that your argument would be the same?
No, Your Honor, I would not.
And why?
During the course of Private Riley's representation by the defense counsel were notified on three different occasions that sex offender registration, specifically the instructions set forth in DODI, were pertinent to their proper representation to their defense counsel. And during this representation of Private Riley, the defense counsel were essentially spoon-fed this information that they should know about this sex offender registration. Now, I understand.
Where in the record is that information that you've just said that they were spoon-fed the information that they should be looking at the sex offender registration?
Your Honor, it's both in the defense counsel's sworn affidavits. And that is why there is no friction between defense counsel's affidavit and Private Riley as far as confinement being the number one issue.
Assert the spoon feeding. Can you just cite in the affidavits, read this, the language that you're relying on? Just be very clear.
Yes, Your Honor.
What your argument is, or what your facts are, rather than your argument.
Yes, Your Honor. Specifically, it was on September 15th, October 28th, and December 4th of 2009. And I'll pull the joint appendix. It's on page, Joint Appendix 22, the third paragraph, explaining that between the emails that were given to the defense counsel from their superiors, the Child Defense Services headquarters, that they were emailed on two occasions about the importance of sex offender registration.
No, and I don't dispute that the information was available there, but you're not suggesting that the defense counsel was. It sounded to me that the argument we were making was that the defense counsel was told, with respect to this particular case, that she was going to need to register as a sex offender.
No, Your Honor, I apologize if that was the interpretation I was
so
giving.
So go back to my question, okay? If there's no sexual overtones whatsoever, okay, in this particular case, so that there would be little reason to look to see if kidnapping a child with no sex involved was in that list. How is that different from if he was charged with, she was charged with larceny and it was also on that list?
Because defense counsel were informed that they needed to look at the list to see that the finite number of crimes that were listed on the DODI.
They were not informed that kidnapping was one of those. They were poked to look at a list, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
That is correct.
That's a little different, isn't it?
I would argue not.
You would argue, okay.
I don't think, I have not heard anyways, that the Child Defense Services headquarters will specifically inform to each offense They were told that the DODI instruction, or I'm sorry, the DOD instruction was permanently important to representing their clients adequately.
And I'm not disagreeing that it's important, and I don't think that you're disagreeing that it's uncommonly silly to have an offense that has nothing to do with sex require registration as a sex offender.
Yes, Your Honor.
So all I'm asking you is, if your answer to my first question, which is that no, consul aren't ineffective if they don't know everything, which is why would they be ineffective for not knowing something which you wouldn't ever think to look at?
And Your Honor, I think that's why both of the granted issues place that responsibility on either defense counsel or the military judge, either to protect the record or to ensure that Private Riley's plea is knowing and voluntary.
Okay. Where's the prejudice here? There is no way I can see that this woman would have been acquitted. They had the video. They had all the stuff that was in her car. They had the ID by the mother. They had her confession. So it's basically a choice between taking a PTA, pleading, and limiting confinement, or not taking a PTA, not pleading, and getting no limitation on confinement. You got to register in either event. So, where's, you know, registration in 5 years, registration in 10 years. Where's the prejudice? She took the five.
Could appellant have pled guilty to the charge of kidnapping without reference to a minor?
Yes, Your Honor. We believe the appellant could have. The appellant could
and
have.
And I would address Judge Stuckey's question in the context of arguing or not whether the appellant could have pled guilty to something other than kidnapping of a minor.
Your Honor, we believe that the appellant could have pled naked by exceptions and substitutions to all of the language except for the minor language, so essentially everything after KL in the specification. And because the minor is not an element that is stated in Article 134 of the MCM, the government would not have been able to produce the child on the merits, and it would have merely been used for sentencing purposes.
What do you mean the government wouldn't have been able to produce the child on the merits?
Your Honor, there would have been no further element for the government to prove up if Private Riley had known she could have pled this way.
How could she have pleaded guilty without explaining that it was a child?
Your Honor, all she needed to make clear that are the elements, and the elements do not require that she state whether or not it's a child or not.
Counsel, I'm not sure we're on track here. If she were charged, or if the government were willing to accept, and the convening authorities wouldn't accept, and the judges wouldn't accept a plea of kidnapping without reference to the child, does that mean that there'd be no, in the findings itself, does that necessarily mean there would be no reference to the child in the plea inquiry or anything else? I don't understand why the child would be excluded from that. They would have a full discussion of all the events, the facts, and circumstances, and it would simply be that the charge that the plea would be entered to would be to kidnapping without a reference in the findings itself. Does that require that there would be no reference to the child at any matter, any point in the proceedings?
No, Your Honor, and I apologize.
Thank
when
you.
I mentioned the merits section, I was essentially discussing a contested trial. Your Honor, you're absolutely correct that the discussion would have been produced during the providence inquiry if there was a child or not.
In fact, even in a contested trial, there would either be the testimony from the child or the testimony about a child. It wouldn't be a secret from anyone.
Yes, Your Honor. And with the with the legislation that we're looking for as far as the prejudice is concerned, that Private Riley has to register as a lifelong sex offender, in the state of Alabama, as well as the federal code that controls sex offender registration, they are not looking towards the underlying facts of the offense, but merely the specification of the charge.
Now, what are the consequences of having to register? I didn't see that. Maybe it's somewhere in the briefs. What are the consequences of having to register?
Your Honor, the state of Alabama...
And I'm not asking you to testify here. I'm asking what we can find either in the record or that we can take judicial notice of.
Your Honor, we included the Alabama Code as well as the U.S. U.S. Code in the joint appendix and request this court to take judicial notice of them. It was also included in the ACCO brief under Article 66 review as well.
And what are the consequences? What in terms of prejudice? What does a person suffer in terms of prejudice, in terms of having to register? There are any number of things that you register for. You know, you can register with certain things at the Security and Exchange Commission, and those are not necessarily matters that published or made public in any way. Some of them, in fact, are treated as confidential. So what are the consequences here of sex registration?
Your Honor, the consequences are that for the rest of Private Riley's life, she would need to register every time she moved and gained employment. Essentially, she would not have been able to choose freely where she lives, raise a family, or works. There is a restriction, a geographical restriction, as to how close she can live, work, next to a church, a park, a library, and these restrictions are lifelong.
Are there any publication requirements in terms of making that information available as to the offense and the location of the individual?
Yes, Your Honor. Virtually every jurisdiction, and specifically Alabama, requires that this information be publicly aware to the public. And this would include the offense for which she is convicted of, a picture of her face, her age, her residence. Essentially, she would be searchable to the entire world.
How is that information made available in the state of Alabama?
Online and on postings, Your Honor.
Your supposition seems to be that if, arguendo, the judge had accepted a plea with exceptions and substitutions, and it had gone through, that somehow this could have been coyly kept from the state of Alabama or any other relevant state. How do we know that?
Your Honor, the language that is included in the specification regarding the minor is superfluous information. I'm sorry, Your Honor?
It's superfluous. Okay, she pled to kidnapping. Well, what if the state of Alabama says, who'd she kidnap? That's an administrative proceeding. It has nothing to do with criminal law. The state of Alabama presumably could find out who she kidnapped and what the circumstances were. So where does that leave you?
Your Honor,
do we know that they would have just said, oh, kidnapping? Do we know that?
Your Honor, what we do know is that Alabama, the state of Alabama, as well as U.S. Code, does not look at the underlying offense, the facts of the underlying offense. What they do require, absolutely require, is if the specification of the charge or the charge itself has falls within a certain list of registrable offenses, then you must register.
Okay, well, you don't disagree that there's nothing wrong with the specification, right?
As written, no, Your Honor.
Okay, and you don't disagree that the government had her confession and the mother's testimony and had the entire case wrapped up and easy, tied with a bow to prove?
Your Honor, I would dispute that. Your summary of the evidence is absolutely correct. However, I would point to Chief Judge Baker's concurring opinion in U.S. v. Bradley, stating that the prejudice opinion is not whether the case was overwhelming or strong, but merely whether appellant's plea was knowing and voluntary. And that
right, except the question here, the prejudice that you're alleging is the registration is a sex offender, right?
The prejudice here, Your Honor, is that Private Riley was not able to make a knowing and voluntary plea because of the mass collateral consequence that was.
She was not able to make a knowing and voluntary plea in choosing between sentence limitation plus registration and no sentence limitation plus registration. Registration is a given.
And Your Honor, we dispute that given for the...
Well, you're saying we can sneak around
Let
that.
Me restate the question. Let me restate the question, because this is something the government, I think, has to address as well and does not agree with you on, which is, had accepting that appellant was not aware that sex registration was a byproduct of pleading guilty to kidnapping a minor, could she have, as part of the plea process, offered to plead guilty to kidnapping, period, without reference to a minor, and accept a higher confinement exposure, instead of 11 years, 20 years?
Absolutely.
In your view, was that a possible, not that the government would accept it, but would it have been possible for her to offer that?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And the government then can indicate what it skirted around in its brief and avoided, which is whether that's a possibility rather than saying that it might or might not be a possibility. Okay, so if that's the case, presumably your prejudice comes from, in the plea context, from the fact that the process did not allow her to make that offer. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay, now let's say you win. If you were to win on issue one or two, what happens in this case? The member sentenced the appellant to 5 years. And by the way, you can have more time to answer my question. I graciously grant you that. You prevail on the plea providence thing. It goes back, what happens? Presumably the cap is 5 years, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
5 years on sentence. And presumably the government could choose to charge the appellant with either offense, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Where does that leave you? The government then turns around and says, okay, thank you. We charge you with kidnapping of a minor.
Yes, Your Honor. It still leaves the appellant in a better position.
Why?
Than today. Because at that point, in the subsequent remand, if this court should choose to do that, at least the appellant would be able to make a knowing and voluntary plea. That is the issue. As far as the confinement...
I mean, she made a knowing and voluntary plea with respect to the elements of the offense, correct?
She did, Your Honor. To the elements of the offense, that is correct. Without knowing the actual post-collateral consequences of
it. But the post-collateral consequences are there whether she knows them or not. And so, fine, as Chief Judge Baker said, you go back. Why would the government have any incentive not to leave the elements there?
Your Honor, there... And I apologize for being over my time.
I'm responsible, not you. Please go.
It's just speculation upon speculation upon speculation.
It is, Your Honor. What we do know is that she did not make a knowing and voluntary plea. Now, the subsequent outcome of the second court-martial, or actually third court-martial, in this instance, is speculation. But as long as Pellant can make a voluntary knowing plea, that is...
But your client's problem is they've lost any leverage to negotiate a different outcome here.
Yes, Your Honor.
You agree with that?
Yes, Your Honor. Absolutely.
Are there any other questions?
Well, that raises a question for me. Let's try to focus on either our case law or the case law of the Supreme Court or really any other jurisdiction. Where would you look for us to explore this proposition? That the prejudice to the appellant in this case, if there is prejudice, as I understand the dialogue that's going on, is a loss of the ability to bargain intelligently in the plea process. That is, the absence of the knowledge about the sex registration requirement then made it impossible for her to enter into a bargain because nobody knew about that particular process. That's different from saying that she didn't plead knowingly and voluntarily to all the elements in the case. So where would we look in either any of the recent decisions of the Supreme Court or any other court for language that would say that a counsel who fails or a judge who fails to make sure that the accused is aware of a major consequence, let's assume that for this case, that this is a major consequence of the guilty plea, that could be used as leverage or a bargaining item, is thereby has the opportunity to void the guilty plea because they couldn't bargain intelligently. Where do we look for the case law on that?
Your Honor, this Court can safely find prejudice in that respect by the Supreme Court's 2012 decisions in Lafler v. Cooper and Missouri v. Fry. Those recent Supreme Court cases, 27 years after Hill, have set a momentum for courts to see prejudice beyond the narrow, strict test of Hill. That is that we're looking for an alternative pleading. We're not there in this case. What we are there is in the Supreme Court's recent decisions. The Supreme Court examined not whether or not they would have taken more favorable plea agreements, not merely that they would have changed the difference of their plea. And I think this Court can safely find prejudice using that philosophy.
Wait a minute. The criterion is whether the government would have accepted a more favorable plea agreement? Is that what you said?
No, Your Honor.
What did you say?
Whether the appellant would have taken a more favorable plea agreement. And again, those cases...
More favorable to whom?
Is it outcome-based or whether it affected the process?
Whether it affected the process, Your
Honor.
More
favorable to whom?
The question still remains, where does that leave you when you have the 5-year cap?
That goes back to the alternate prejudice finding, which is that Private Riley would have known during the, if this case should be remanded, that her plea was knowing and voluntary.
I mean, just one small question about, and you can address it on rebuttal, which is in terms of the 2012 Supreme Court cases, there it seems to me that there was a uncommunicated offer from the government, okay? And in this case, there's no such offer, and your suggestion that such an offer would have been, from your client, would have been accepted or entertained, or whether there was any reason for the government to do that, is purely speculation. So if you could address how you fit the facts of this case into those Supreme Court cases on rebuttal, I would appreciate it.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge Baker, judges of the court, may it please the court. My name is Captain Dan Maurer, Major Captain Dell, and I represent the United States in this matter. Appellant's counsel, defense counsel team, was not ineffective under a Strickland prejudice test, nor was appellant's plea involuntary under U.S. v. Miller and U.S. v. Badania. Addressing the IAC claim first, this claim is meritless because there is no reasonable probability that she would have contested this charge had she been told about the requirement. In other words, there is no, quote, substantial likelihood of a different result. That comes from...
Does that mean you're avoiding prong one, or you concede prong one and are moving on to prong two?
No, Your Honor, we're simply saying that this court doesn't need to decide on prong one because you can address in government's favor on prong two alone. So we don't need to get to that question.
If we did address it, what would your position be?
If we were to address it, Your Honor, and I guess that means I am, it's not deficient for three basic reasons. I think, one, Miller itself clearly says failure to abide by this prospective suggestion about entering part of the plea colloquy along these lines does not make that alone deficient. Second, under Strickland...
Well, it doesn't say not alone. It makes it not per se. It doesn't say, in theory, it could alone do that. It's just not per se.
That's correct, Your Honor. The second reason why I think this would be deficient under these circumstances is precisely that reason. Strickland says it must be reasonable or unreasonable under the circumstances. Here, it's counterintuitive, as this court has implied during the previous discussion. It's counterintuitive that kidnapping of a minor would be listed under the DOD instruction for sex offender registrable offenses, just like larceny, just like some other assault offenses, like conduct unbecoming an officer.
It might be counterintuitive, but who is supposed to safeguard the defendant's interests in these if it's not the defense attorney? Obviously, it is counterintuitive, but isn't that the reason that they had the bench book instruction and the Miller requirement, that's part of the defense attorney's duty to go out and ferret out these things?
Well, certainly, Your Honor, under Miller and Badania, it's clear the chief reliance on these kinds of consequences of a conviction fall chiefly and really only on the defense counsel. But that does not make it deficient under Strickland. Indeed, if you look at Padilla, where Padilla goes back and says, failure to advise correctly or at all about deportation consequences, the nexus of immigration law and criminal law, they looked at what the prevailing norms were. And they looked at several things. They looked at the ABA standards. They looked at the DOJ prosecutorial guidelines. They looked at the National Legal Aid and Defender Association guidelines for representation of criminal defendants during guilty pleas. And in those sources, they found justification for saying the professional norm is to advise about deportation. Now, if this court were to look back at those same kinds of sources, or even to look at the AR 2726, which is the Army Rules for Professional Conduct of Lawyers, or the Trial Defense Service's own SOP, none of these say counsel must advise, even after Padilla, must advise clients about sex offender possibility or requirements post-conviction. None of them establish that as a baseline norm. So if you look at those three things, I think that would give this court enough...
What about the appellate rights form and the instructions? that the defense attorney should advise on those issues.
Certainly, but I think that is not the same thing as saying one of the collateral consequences of a conviction and a guilty plea would be sex offender in state X. No court has established that as a baseline norm, and this court doesn't need to go there anyway because this court can decide.
What about under DOD instruction? Forget state X. Why, having been provided the list, why is it effective representation to not read the list or not apply the list?
Well, certainly, Your Honor, I think, you know, if this were a different fact pattern, obviously, if this were a sex case, and this experienced defense counsel forgot to look at the DVI or just completely avoided the discussion with the client, this would be a different matter altogether. But ineffective is two prongs. It's deficient performance, falling below a reasonable standard of care, and prejudice. And the government's arguably best case here, best argument, is the prejudice prong under Strickland. And the prejudice prong under Strickland applied to this particular fact pattern.
Right, we get you just spent three minutes telling us
you into doing prong one.
We're still in prong one. Okay, let's stay there for a while.
And the fact that you want to move so quickly and hard to prong two is not indicating great strength on prong one. You had three arguments. You've done two. What was the third?
The first one, Your Honor, if I can recap, the first one was Miller doesn't establish that as a standard. Second one was
per se.
Correct. Under the circumstances, under Strickland, this is a counterintuitive sex offender crime.
Before we leave that, is it the government's position that it's irrational? It's that if we had the larceny case that was talked about before, we might have an argument about whether it was irrational to require sex registration for people who engage in larceny. Is it irrational for the government to require sex registration for individuals who are involved in kidnapping minor children?
I can't speak for Congress or the DOD, Your Honor, but I can say that the DODI in question is built upon not just sex offenses, but offenses against minor children. And in most of the cases outlined, it's a nexus between the two, sex offenses against minors. I can't say one way or the other whether it's rational to include kidnapping parenthetical of a minor by non-minor parent within that list. I can't say that. What I can say is, under these circumstances, in this case where the charge is kidnapping and there is no sexual overtone, no sexual component whatsoever, it was not irrational or unreasonable for the counsel not to be searching back in their memories whether or not this particular offense fell under that table.
So is it rational for the government to impose a lifetime punishment of sex registration?
Your Honor, that's a policy question that this court doesn't have to answer.
Well,
I can't answer.
Should we specify that as an issue in this case? That is, we've got someone who the government's coming and saying, gee, it's counterintuitive to have this person have for anyone to even think that this person would have to engage in sex registration. Now we've got an individual whose name and picture is going to be published on the internet. If she has children, assuming she's allowed to have children under the rule, let's assume that, she's not going to be able to have her children be a parent that associates with any other parent. She's going to have all these other restrictions on her life. Is that something that we ought to specify as to whether that perhaps maybe under Article 55, lifetime stigma? Is it any different from the branding that's outlawed under Article 55 to have somebody's picture on the internet for the rest of their life like that and have those restrictions on them?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think this court, certainly not from this case, is in a position to pass on whether or not Congress should have included this as one of those.
Well, then why don't we focus on whether counsel, under those circumstances, if it's not so irrational for the government to do that, should have been prepared to advise the client in these circumstances.
I think we can say plausibly that under these circumstances they weren't deficient. But assuming they are, assuming for the sake of...
Can you do me a favor and just say your third thing? We're boxing you into this. You're trying to argue prejudice and we're making you argue other things about branding and such. But
yes, Your Honor.
Just say your third argument and then move on to prejudice if that's okay, or move on to responding to Judge Efron. But...
Okay.
Just get your third argument out there, please.
I did hit all three, Your Honor. The first one was Miller. The second was under the circumstances counterintuitive. And the third one was looking back at the same sources that Padilla Court did, you would not find this established as one of those norms of defense counsel practice. So that was the third point.
Counsel, does the record reflect at all that the government knew that sex registration was a requirement? Is that something that they were looking for?
No, Your Honor, not at all. It's clear from the first two results of trial, sorry, the first result of trial that was published in the immediate aftermath of the court, that the trial counsel, the government did not realize that this was a sex offender registration.
So the defense counsel, trial counsel, the military judge,
none
of them knew.
And I think that arguably could be a sign of, again, prevailing professional norm, is no one knew, to include the court, that this, on its face, was a sex offender registrable crime. So, assuming arguendo it's sufficient, the obviously the strength of the government's case here is that it fails, the appellant fails to meet her burden to establish prejudice. And it is her burden alone that comes straight from Donato, straight from every case dealing with IAC. And the standard here, you know, at the risk of sounding a bit pithy, is it boils down to this, to plead or not to plead, and that's the question. It's not to change her bargaining position, change her posture. It's to plead guilty or not to plead guilty and contest the trial. That established in Hill.
It's not the plea process itself, it's just the total outcome, yes or no, on guilt.
It's the process to the extent that it changes a plea from yes, I'm going to plead guilty, to no, I'm not going to plead.
It has nothing to do with the sentence or anything else.
No,
it's just you're either guilty or you're not. Frye stands for the proposition that if you agreed to 100 years in guilt, even if the fact you didn't know about would have limited you to 1 year, but you agreed to 100. No problem, because it's guilt or no guilt.
Well, the way I read Lockhart, Rose, Netto, and Bradley from last term is when you're looking at prejudice under IAC for this particular fact pattern, where it's failure to advise about registration, the question is, but for the alleged error, would she have insisted on going to trial because it's, quote, rational not to plead guilty? And this is an objective test. So what we're looking at then is things like, did she say anything during the pretrial process? Here there's no, because no one knew about the requirement. Did she say anything in her affidavit post-trial that would establish that this was her key concern, her primary, the onus on her, or the...
But what we don't know is whether she would have traded confinement for taking the word minor out of the charge, correct?
That's correct, and it is worth repeating that the appellant has the burden to establish that that's the case, and they have not done so here. And I think it's not necessarily disingenuous, but it's not viable for the government to remove the minor spec, the minor language from the spec. And I'd like to talk on that for just a few seconds here. I don't think it would have been viable for 3 reasons. One, I think it was inconsequential, because contrary to what my colleague has said, whether or not an offense falls under DODI is not based on the language of the spec. It's on the underlying offense. And you can look at the table itself, table 27, in page 109 or whatever it is of the instruction, where it lists the dozen or so offenses. It lists Article 134, kidnapping, parenthetical, by a person, not the parent. Article 134 itself has no such delineation among the elements. There is no minor element to the offense, and there is no second version of kidnapping that involves a minor. It's simply kidnapping. So that tells you that, plus the fact that Article 133, conduct of becoming an officer, is also in there with another parenthetical discussing kidnapping of a minor, tells you it's not the name of the offense itself. It's the facts underneath it. And here, so assuming you take out the minor, it's...
So is that the government's assertion as the government in this case, that the registration requirement would have applied irrespective of the language in the charge, as long as there was a kidnapping in the charge, that the government would have been obligated to report this as a sex registration matter?
Yes, Your Honor. And I think that
regardless of the minor being in the charge at all?
Yes, Your Honor. Because the facts themselves, there's this reason, or the second reason why it would have been not viable in this case. You can't enter into a provident plea, or you'd have a failure of proof if the minor is taken out entirely. If you look at the...
Well, I think the defense has agreed with that now, that despite the statements earlier in their argument, that they agree that the facts would have come out. So I think the sole question here is, do those facts make this a reportable offense, irrespective of whether the child is listed in the findings?
Yes, I believe that's... I believe that's the case. There's just no way that this case could have moved forward without the fact coming up that the victim was a minor. There's no way to prove, again, one of the elements is it has to be against someone's will, whether it's the adult victim or, in the case of a minor, against the victim minor's parent or guardian. So when you get to that part of the providence inquiry and you're talking to the accused about, well, against whose will was this, necessarily, in order to get to the provident plea, you've got to raise the fact that this is a minor and it was against the minor parent's will. That has to come in. So I think under those circumstances, this is going to trigger the DUDI regardless of how it's pled and regardless of how it's specified. It's still going to trigger that requirement. Moreover, there's no incentive whatsoever, based on the facts of this case, for the government to change its plea. So say they had known that this was a sex offender registrable offense, and they thought, that's pretty bad, that's too bad for her, that is a lifelong stigma. But this case is so overwhelmingly against the accused in terms of the viability and volatility of the evidence. You've got the eyewitness account of the mother, you've got...
That's all true, but what if the appellant... The government has not asserted that this is a sex offender case. At trial, it was not viewed as a sex offender case. So what if the appellant, the accused, had come and said, "I'll give me 20 years? You're saying the government had no incentive to negotiate on this, but why wouldn't they have said, "Well, we agree it's not a sex offender case, so we'll go ahead and give you 20 years in exchange for whatever we can give you"? By agreeing that this isn't a sex offender case.
Your Honor, I think that is a possible alternative scenario. It could have happened that way. But the point is, the appellant bears the burden, has always borne the burden of, or borne the burden, I suppose, of raising that as objective evidence why she was prejudiced under these facts. And that is simply not the case. All she points to is, again, as Judge Ryan pointed out, speculation upon speculation upon speculation about what the government's position would have been, could have been, what the appellant's bargaining position would have looked like differently. That is not the test. The test comes from Hill.
Here's a completely different question. Even assuming that we agree with you that there's no IAC, and even if we agree with you that the military judge didn't do anything wrong, because there's no reason anyone would have known or should have known, for the same reasons that you're arguing that they shouldn't, that there's no reason that they should have known, don't those same reasons suggest that she should not be registered as a sex offender? And so my question is, does the government have any power or authority to change that fact? And if so, why doesn't it?
I disagree in part with your first question, and to your second question, I don't think, certainly the judge nor the prosecutor in this case had any discretion whatsoever in terms of whether or not this charge is going to, a conviction for this charge would have led to a federal registration or state registration. They had no discretionary power. I think that answers your question. I'm not sure.
What do we know, or do we know anything about the processes by which this stuff gets into federal or state files? Let's take the state of Alabama, since it's been kicked around here. What do we know about what has to be provided by somebody? Is it the convening authority to the state of Alabama, or what the state of Alabama asks for, or what the form looks like, or anything like this? Do we know anything?
Frankly, Your Honor, I can't answer that in any great detail, and I would defer to my colleague.
Okay, I will ask on rebuttal.
Counsel, let's go back to the issue of whether it would have been rational to plead guilty, as opposed to the issue of whether there was a bargaining power issue here. Again, looking at what we learned from Article 55, there's a time in this country when stigma was a major form of punishment in criminal offenses, whether we go back to the time of the Scarlet Letter or branding or tattooing, which were not unusual in civilian proceedings as well as military proceedings well into the 19th century. And we had very few penitentiaries then. Stigma was considered very major. Stigma still is thought of as a major consequence of a criminal conviction. And here we've got a question of a lifetime stigma. For all she knows, lifetime on the internet, lifetime restrictions on her life, on her ability to parent, etc. Why would it have been irrational for her to say, if I can't get a deal, even if the odds against me are high in terms of beating the charge at trial, these consequences are so severe that I'm going to take my chances? Why is that irrational when facing the type of consequences of a sex offender registration?
Well, I don't think it would be irrational, Your Honor, but that's not, I don't think that's the question here, because the appellant must show that in her case, the assuming deficient performance prejudiced her. And you have no post-trial affidavit that clearly establishes that this was the most significant thing in her universe. What she could have said, and she did not say. This is exactly what the Hill v. Lockhart court looked for but could not find when they said there was prejudice. They looked in his post-trial habeas petition, and they looked for matters of particular emphasis. Something that supports.
At a time when she, are you arguing now or then?
I think to answer your question, Your Honor, you can look at either one. So if you have.
Well, of course, it wasn't a point of emphasis then because she didn't know about it.
Correct. But at the post-trial phase, when she does know about it, you could raise matters of particular emphasis for in the habeas petition. Here, she could have said in her affidavit, I have nieces and nephews, and the prospect of not being able to interact with them, to have time with them, or I want to be a teacher someday, and offender registration would have precluded that entirely, or this would have affected everything from my ability to get an education to professional choice to interaction with my family or where I wanted to live. She could have said all those things. Though that, if she had done so, might have provided this court some objective matters of particular emphasis that the scorecard looked for in Hill to support her conclusion that she would not have pled guilty had she known this. And that's all it is. It's a conclusion without basis, and that's what it boils down to.
So the government agrees then that even when there's overwhelming evidence, there can be circumstances, and you're not conceding in this case, where it would be rational for the accused to say, based on the consequences, I'm going to trial. I would go to trial. It would be rational for me to go to trial.
Yes, that's correct.
Thank you.
This court has not said that the overwhelming evidence is the sole factor that would make that possible.
And counsel, I'm sorry, but I don't think you answered my first question, which is it the government's position, irrespective of the discretion of the military judge in this case, is it the government's position that there's facts in this record that suggest that this appellant needs to be registered as a sex offender? That's my first question.
I said I'm over my time. I'll just answer your question very quickly. No,
answer it with all due care.
I think there's no evidence in the record.
Okay, so then my second question is, does the government know or can it find out whether there's anything that the government can do about that particular fact? To unregister her.
I don't believe there's a discretionary option at the military level. Being authority judge, I don't believe that's the case. So I think it triggers an automatic conviction, would trigger an automatic registration under the DODI and the federal law.
To be clear, you're not really sure, are you?
No, frankly, I can't say that with 100% confidence. But I don't think that changes the ultimate calculus about prejudice.
That is irrespective, and I think I made that clear, even assuming that we agree with you on all those things. This is a different question, right? It's about fairness, which isn't necessarily within our discretion either, but I'm just asking.
I would agree with that, Your Honor. Thank you. If there are no further questions, the government asks that you affirm the findings and sentence in this case. Thank you.
I'm stalling because I'm trying to see whether you're going to get away with saying we shouldn't care about fairness. Does the government care about fairness?
Yes, Your Honor.
As a representative of the United States government, is fairness part of what you look for in how you approach your job?
It is absolutely an element under CRCM 306 for commander discretion, for prosecutorial discretion, absolutely is part of the calculus. But it's not part of the calculus that this court needs to employ when they're looking at error and looking at deficiency of performance.
But counsel, do you understand the different question, right, which is would you agree that it is more appropriate for the government to be trying to correct things on a fairness level, right, which doesn't have to do with the answers to the issues that are before us, right? The legal issues can be, the answers could be, yes, there's no ineffective assistance of counsel, and yes, the military judge didn't do anything wrong, right? But if the other answer is, but she shouldn't have, she shouldn't have to register as a sex offender. Would you agree that that's your job, not ours? And if so, why would you not look into it and fix it?
Again, with all honesty, Your Honor, I can't answer that question. I can say this, though. I think this court recognized that problem in Miller and fashioned the suggested rule going forward. And I think that's kind of the policy question.
Which the government now says doesn't apply.
Well, not in the way that the appellant thinks it does.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for the appellant.
So my first question to you, counsel, for the appellant is, do you know, is there a way for the government to fix it? Do you understand? I mean, let's not speaking for other judges in the court. Speaking for myself, if I think that the legal answers to the questions are, no, there's no ineffective assistance of counsel, and no, the military judge did nothing wrong, that's my answer to those questions, right? But my question to you is there something that the government can do that's not related to the questions?
No, Your Honor. The government would have to modify the specification in order to remedy the prejudice issue.
What if she went to the correction board and asked for relief? Under the Secretary's statutory power to correct military records in cases of error and injustice. And that is an equitable standard. Now, the statute doesn't allow you to change the findings of court-martial. But we're not talking about the findings of court-martial here. What we're talking about is the applicability of a particular administrative regulation, which is within the ambit of the Secretary of Defense.
Your Honor, in an administrative realm, there may be a possibility such as that.
Well, it's an administrative proceeding, is it not?
It is, Your Honor. And
we're not talking about it. It's a collateral consequence. I mean, that's a nasty word anymore, but it's a collateral consequence. It's an administrative collateral consequence, is it not?
It is, Your Honor.
Okay, so she might be able to get relief that way? I'm just asking.
Possibly, Your Honor.
Possibly.
Yes, I believe if...
Can I ask you a question about your case? I'm sorry, but I'm not sure where everybody's in the speculation mode right now.
Yeah.
Is it your view, and please defend your view one way or the other, that one, it's the nature of the offense, what it is described as, 134, kidnapping of a minor when you're not the parent. Is it the specification itself and whether or not minor is referred to, or is it the plea facts themselves which triggers the reporting requirement that you are here appealing?
Yes, Your Honor.
Which is it?
It is the specification of the charge, and that is outlined and included in the joint appendix for Alabama State Code and the U.S. Code.
And what is your support for the statement that it's the specification one looks to versus the title of the offense or the facts of the offense?
In scouring the other states, Your Honor, to determine their registration requirements, there is generally, some states have a catch-all phrase. If it is not listed within the 1 through 22 sex offense registrable offenses, there's a last statement which says, even if none of the offenses are listed here, if the offense includes the offense of a minor, then you still need to register. That does not exist in the U.S. Code, and it does not exist in Alabama State Code.
But under the Alabama State Court Code, if it's registrable under the DOD instruction, then it's registrable under Alabama regardless, correct?
And the
government counsel is correct that there is no offense listed under Article 134 of kidnapping. There's no aggravating element. It simply isn't an offense if you kidnap someone and it is your own child.
Yes, Your Honor. However, the DODI does not mandate registration. That is not the controlling statute that Congress has enacted. It is the U.S. Code that mandates registration. The DODI is merely an instruction to the confinement facility for what they need to do administratively. So what Private Riley is being subjected to is Alabama State Code and the U.S. Code, not the DODI. So if the DODI says that you have to register for this offense...
Let me follow up, because this is what I asked the government.
You did, Your Honor.
What do we know? You looked at the Alabama statute, and all that is, I think, a laundry list of offenses, right?
That is correct.
Okay. And you're saying, well, the facts are irrelevant because there's no sweep-in clause.
Yes, Your Honor.
How do we know that? Do you, have you looked at the forms? Have you looked at the quantum of data required by the state of Alabama or any other state, or did you just look at the statute?
I looked at the statute.
Okay. Did you look at the administrative regulations of the state carrying out the statute, implementing the statute?
We did, Your Honor.
What did they say?
Well, Your Honor, and I apologize, that was not included in the joint appendix, and we could supplementally.
That's all right. What did they say?
But no. The statute is what controls, and that is why we included that in the joint appendix, and that is what.
But under the statute, I don't understand why she needs to register at all, because it says a sex offender means an individual who is convicted of a sex offense, right? And you agreed that this was not a sex offense.
Yes, Your Honor.
And then it says in terms of sex offender is a sex offender whose offense is punishable by imprisonment for more than 1 year and involves kidnapping. But don't they have to be a sex offender to begin with? I'm just confused.
No, Your Honor, I believe when the statutes are implementing kidnapping of a minor, what they're talking about is kidnapping a minor for sexual purposes, and not in this you know, rare occurrence of the facts that we have in our case. And that's why it is confusing, because the sex offense registration was not, and this is me proffering essentially, was not meant for this type of offense. It was not made for these set of circumstances. And I think that is why the MCM includes language such as a minor or not being a guardian or a parent, because they are looking for sexual offenses.
They're trying to not criminalize someone taking their child, that is their child, away from the other parent. They're trying to make that not a kidnapping.
Right.
That's what that language is doing.
Well, yes, Your Honor. I mean, that falls within the bubble in which the emphasis of the offense is. But this court, to the government counsel, kept on referring back to the strength of the evidence and the government's, whether or not they would have wanted to plea or not. It is important to preface that Private Riley had already been reduced to E1, received forfeitures, and received a punitive discharge from a prior court-martial. In essence, confinement was the only one, was her number one priority, because it was her only priority. And we respectfully ask this court to emphasize on the importance that Private Riley would have placed on the collateral consequence when she made her plea. Thank you.
Thank you. The court thanks both counsel, and both counsel, we thank you for addressing many different questions, some that were squarely within the strike zone and some that were on or about the plate. Thank you very much, and the case is now submitted. And we stand in recess until further order of the court.
All rise. Court stands in recess until 9:30 tomorrow morning.